Welcome to The Telegram. My name is Tim Stanley. This week we're asking, is Iran being set up by America? Is the Islamic Republic really trying to build a nuclear bomb to terrorize the rest of us? Or is it a peace-loving country being smeared by its imperialist enemies? Also, what does it mean to be English? Is it just a byword for skinhead racism or an identity worthy of celebration? I'm joined in the studio by Peter Oborne, the Daily Telegraph's chief political commentator, David Morrison, an independent foreign policy analyst, Con Coughlan, the Daily Telegraph's defence editor, Jenny McCartney, a columnist for the Sunday Telegraph, and Damian Thompson, editor of Telegraph Blogs. Iran is the victim of a smear campaign. That's the claim by Peter Oborne and David Morrison in their new book, A Dangerous Delusion: Why the West is Wrong About Nuclear Iran. The authors insist that all the available evidence shows that the Islamic Republic's nuclear program is in fact peaceful. They write that, quote, "We concede that it is indeed possible that the Iranians are secretly pursuing a nuclear bomb. However, we can show that there is at present no convincing evidence for this belief. Any Western politician or propagandist who claims otherwise is either ignorant of the facts or lying." Oborne and Morrison conclude that the purpose behind this myth is to give the United States an excuse to pursue, quote, "the humiliation and eventual destruction of Iran's Islamic regime." So is Iran the victim of a giant setup? I'm joined by Peter Oborne and David Morrison, who will argue that she is, and by Con Coughlan, who is a little more skeptical. Starting with David, explain your case.
The dangerous delusion referred to in our book is that Iran is an extremely aggressive state that is hell-bent on getting nuclear weapons. In fact, Iran has been, in the 20th century, subject to a great deal of aggression. But as far as nuclear weapons is concerned, what is never mentioned in coverage of the nuclear activities of Iran is that since November 2007, the U.S. intelligence agency have been of the opinion that Iran has not had an active nuclear weapons program and hasn't had one since 2003. As recently as March the 12th this year, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, repeated to the Senate Intelligence Committee that the situation hadn't changed, that Iran, in the opinion of U.S. intelligence, had not decided to make nuclear weapons. It appears as if Israel is also of the same opinion. A year ago, Benny Gantz, head of the Israeli Defense Forces, said in an interview with Haaretz that, in his opinion, Iran had not decided to make a nuclear weapon, and indeed, he offered the view that they probably never would.
Thank you. So, Con, I'm reading the book. What's very striking is this point, that evidence of them actually definitely doing it for military purposes has not been convincingly found.
Yes, well, my dear colleague Peter Oborne has given me a copy of the book, no doubt in the hope that he will persuade me it has some merit. I'm afraid I can't agree with my dear friend Mr. Oborne. In fact, I would say the only people guilty of a dangerous delusion are the authors. And basically from page one, the whole structure of this book is just completely erroneous. If I might just say, at the start, in the introduction, we have this absolutely ludicrous statement that since Iran joined the National Proliferation Treaty on the 1st July 1968, for the most part, it has obediently respected its provisions and continues to do so today. I mean, this is how the book starts. And you just have to look. I mean, I don't know whether the authors have bothered to do this, but the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, which is an independent UN-funded body which has been monitoring Iran's nuclear program for the best part of a decade, has serious concerns. And the head of the IAEA himself has declared that he believes there's enough evidence that Iran is working towards a nuclear program, a nuclear weapons program.
If you let me just finish,
David, thank you very much. You've had your say. And the other thing, which you just glossed over quite conveniently, is that until 2003, The Western intelligence community is in agreement, is of accord, that Iran did have a nuclear weapons program. You conceded that yourself. It had it until 2003. Why did it get rid of it? It got rid of it because we invaded it, neighboring Iraq, and the Ayatollahs took fright and gave it up, just like Gaddafi in Libya. So to say, which is your fundamental thesis of this book, that Iran has never had a nuclear weapons program is complete and utter nonsense.
David.
The book doesn't actually say that. But getting back to the IAEA, Mr. Romano said on the Today program on the BBC that the IAEA wasn't saying that Iran had a nuclear weapons program.
I didn't say that either.
Well,
and if your research is done on what he says on the Today program, that's pretty poor research in my book.
Is the problem not evenly balanced, that on the one hand we have no concrete evidence that it is doing it, on the other hand the IAEA has said that it has concerns and is worried, cannot rule out that it isn't doing it?
It has got concerns, yes, but they consist of allegations which probably wouldn't have
come in. They
consist of allegations in the annex to the November 2011 report from the IAEA. They are allegations. The word allegation or variants of that appears in the annex 28 times. It's possible, obviously, that some of it is true, but they consist of allegations, and they're mostly before 2003.
Well, this is such a naive.
Can we come back?
Let me just finish, Peter. David's making these assertions, and they need to be corrected. For the past decade or more, Iran has deliberately set out to deceive the IAEA. The Natanz Enrichment Center was concealed.
They didn't have to reveal it. They broke no rules by concealing it.
Well, why do you build an uranium enrichment bunker 40 feet underground, conceal it from the West and the IAEA?
What about that?
Do you want to let me finish? Conceal it from the IAEA. When they claim that their intentions are completely peaceable. The other really important thing about what is going on at Natanz and the other secret establishment that was only revealed by President Obama in 2009, another enrichment facility at Fordow, the fundamental issue about this and the reason there is legitimate concern in the West is the uranium being produced at those plants is completely unsuitable for the nuclear power installations that they are building. So how do you square that? If you really are set on a course of peace, of developing nuclear power, then why are you enriching uranium to a level that is only used in nuclear weapons, apart from all the missile systems?
That's also untrue.
With all the missile systems that the North Koreans have done, the triggering devices, and all the other illicit traces of enriched uranium that have been found at various plants.
Thank you, Conrad.
The body of evidence is so compelling, I think it is quite fatuous to come out with this kind of proposition.
Peter, I'd like to bring you in because you wanted to say something earlier, to bring it back. What is it you want to bring it back to?
Yes, and I'd like to put this to Con.
Please do.
Which is that the basic structure which governs all of these arguments, is the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Right.
Which Iran signed up to in 1968.
Under the Shah.
Under the Shah, indeed, and has in general adhered to absolutely ever since. And the key requirement there is that you guarantee, as a signatory, not to develop, or bargain, one might even call it, not to develop nuclear weapons, but you can have, as a signatory, unless you're China or America, you can have peaceful nuclear weapons. And as part of that deal, you allow complete access to your nuclear establishments to the IAEA. And that is what Iran does. All of its nuclear facilities are open at all times to IAEA inspectors at very short notice. And what that distinguishes Iran from its main enemy at the moment, Israel, whose nuclear establishments are completely closed, more or less, to the outside world, and indeed it distinguishes it from India, which has been allowed, even though it's outside the NPT, to develop nuclear weapons.
I think this is a very important point, Con, that you have to answer, because under that 1968 non-proliferation treaty, my reading of it is that countries are permitted, for peaceful reasons, to enrich uranium. But this extraordinary extra commitment has been placed upon Iran that it can't do it within its own country, that it must purchase it from overseas. Is that not a double standard? And is that not just because the US happens to not like Iran?
Well, firstly, what I would say about that is the reason that these extraordinary requirements have been placed on Iran is because of Iran's extraordinary conduct over a period not just of a decade. I mean, the really key nuclear facilities were built in Iran when the so-called moderates were in power, people like Rafsanjani Khatami. These were the people that were trying to get rid of Ahmadinejad in the last Iranian election. But when the moderates were in power, they were still building nuclear facilities. And fine, you know, I can see that the NPT says that you can conduct enrichment. But the reason we have so much concern about Iran is, A, who is running Iran? If Iran were to have a nuclear weapon, who would control it? Would it be the spiritual leader, the Revolutionary Guards? Would it be the so-called democratically elected president? But again, coming back to Peter's delusional view of this subject, he was talking earlier about peaceable nuclear weapons. Well, that
peaceful,
to me,
I did not talk about
you peaceful. said peace.
I
that's
said
what you said, Peter.
Peaceful nuclear. Power.
He did say a nuclear program for peaceful means. He didn't mean weapons for peaceful reasons.
Anyway, to get the person, by the way, just to get this point clear, the person who would make the decision if Iran were to develop nuclear weapons would be the supreme leader, who again and again has declared, issued a fatwa against nuclear weapons,
Iranian propaganda.
And declared that it's un-Islamic. Well, why would he go on making this assertion if it was propaganda? Because if he did start to develop nuclear weapons, he'd have an enormous difficulty in explaining that to the rest of the world.
And actually, Peter and David in the book do make a very interesting point that the Iranian society is very complicated, its government's very complicated, and that when it comes to decisions about foreign policy, you have to weigh up the popular will as is reflected in elections, the Islamic judgment of the priests who run the country. This isn't just like North Korea. This isn't power in one man's hands, one vision of what Iranian foreign policy should be. It's a lot more complicated and sophisticated than that, Con.
Well, I think you give them a lot more credit, actually. I mean, one of the other disappointing parts of the book, I think, is that they concentrate on this meeting in 2005 when the Iranians are supposed to have given an offer to do a deal on its nuclear enrichment program. In fact, the two key moments, if you've done your research properly, when the West and Iran could have had an engagement was after the 9/11 attacks, when Iran did offer to help the Bush administration to get rid of the Taliban. Iran had its own geostrategic interest in doing that. They didn't like the Taliban, etc. And that was overlooked. That was when Khatami was in power. And more recently, in 2009, at the Geneva conference, Iran put forward another proposal. And in fact, on that occasion, the Western powers, led by President Barack Obama, and frankly, to say that people like Barack Obama, who've prostrated themselves over the whole Iran issue from the moment he entered the White House, are not interested in doing a deal with the Ayatollahs is, again, a rather silly thing to say. But the reason that that deal got nowhere is the Iranian negotiating team, and this is picking up your point, Tim, went back to Tehran, and they basically, in principle, agreed to this deal. They put it up to the supreme leader, who said, no way. And this is not the first occasion this has happened. Throughout the course of the West's attempt, and it is led by the West, although Russia now plays a lot more attention to what's going on in Tehran. Now they realize their missiles are a lot closer to Moscow than London and Washington. But the whole problem with this is that time and again, we've sat down with the Iranians, we've got close to a deal. The Iranians have suggested that they would engage. Then they go back to Tehran, and a different body of people, coming back to your point about the complexity of Iranian society, take an opposite decision.
And that's a very important point, David, about how this is not an ordinary state. And something that I must confess troubled me when reading the book was the suggestion that this is an ordinary state that can be understood in rational terms. I mean, you're absolutely right that the West has done terrible things to Iran, and in particular sponsoring the Iran-Iraq war, in which Iraq used gas weapons.
Nobody told Saddam to invade Iran. No, I mean,
but on the flip side of that, Con, Iran does have a terrible human rights record. And during that war, it used human wave attacks in order to clear minefields. It drove its own soldiers.
Well, I was there. I was there with the Revolutionary Guards and the Shatl Arab.
Absolutely. So we're not dealing with an ordinary democratic state. We're dealing with a power which, in many ways, we don't understand and which can be very frustrating in its behavior. It does, after all, sponsor terrorism overseas. There's a case this week about an Al-Qaeda cell turning up in Canada that's supposed to be financed by Iran. So how do you respond to the challenge that this is not a northern state?
That is so suspicious. The idea that Iran would sponsor an Al-Qaeda cell is the sheerest fantasy and delusion. I mean, Al-Qaeda and Iran...
But it has sponsored Hezbollah. It has sponsored other groups which have carried out terror attacks. Well,
Hezbollah only 2 months ago killed a load of people in Bulgaria. I mean,
unclear that that was Hezbollah.
But I think this, for me, is the most important point in the book. It's a question of trust, and I think some people do not trust Iran.
Let's go back to what happened after 9/11. I mean, it is true to say that Iran not only offered help, but gave help to the Bush administration post 9/11, for their own reasons, I accept. They didn't like the Taliban either. But the reward they got for doing that was to be put on the axis of evil in January 2002. And when, sometime in 2003, they yet again, at least certainly there was an offer that came from Tehran. You can argue about how official it was, but an offer came from Tehran in May 2003 for comprehensive negotiations. And as the Leverett's in their book Going to Tehran explain, when it arrived in the White House ignored it.
I mean, but why wouldn't you ignore the proposals put forward by a regime which sponsors terrorism and which, for example, held a conference to discuss the historical veracity of the Holocaust? I mean, this doesn't feel like a state that can be trusted or even should be trusted.
I'm not sure whether the conference actually said that. Now, I've never come across. You may be right, indeed. I've never come across a statement from Ahmadinejad saying that the Holocaust didn't happen. He said other things that question the Holocaust and the numbers killed in the Holocaust. Yes, but I've never come across an absolute denial of it.
Well, questioning numbers is usually step one towards denying at least its moral significance. I mean, it's something that normally only nutcases trees do in Montana.
The point is, let's go on then to situations in which Iran made offers. There is absolutely no doubt in March 2005, when a process of negotiations, which has been set out in the Paris Agreement the previous November, were taking place between Iran, Britain, France and Germany, there is no doubt that they made a very substantial offer, which people in the room regarded as significant. And they, in particular, they offered something close to guarantees that their nuclear activity wouldn't be for weapons purposes, because they, on the question of enriching uranium, they offered that once uranium was enriched to 5%, which is appropriate for a nuclear reactor, that the uranium would then be turned into fuel rods, which makes it next to impossible to go back and further enrich.
To conclude,
I just want to pick up that. I mean, the reason that deal failed comes back to the point I made earlier, that the politicians and the experts who've been dealing with Iran for the best part of a decade did not believe that the people in that negotiating room could deliver on the promises they made. And a few months later, Ahmadinejad was elected. He was Khomeini's chosen candidate. And immediately, the whole enrichment program was resumed to a very high level. So this is what's happened. And you really have to study the diplomacy of this over a very long period. But you know, to come back to your fundamental thesis, that the West has deliberately been trying to pick a fight with Iran and humiliate it and pick up all the old old saws about Mossadegh and everything like that is a very, very strange interpretation of what's happened.
The programme was relaunched perfectly reasonably so because of our British and Western intransigence just before Ahmadinejad took over as president. And yet, Ahmadinejad made this sensational offer in late 2005 of co-ownership of the nuclear facilities. And so I don't think he's as unreasonable as you suggest.
Con Cotton, Peter Oborne and David Morrison, thank you very much. We all know that God is an Englishman, but if that's the case, then why are the English so reluctant to celebrate their greatness? This week, St. George's Day came and went with all the usual hand-wringing about why don't we celebrate it and what does it really mean to be English anyway? Is Englishness something to be frightened of? Anti-British, exclusivist, even implicitly racist? Or is it a forgotten and noble identity worth promoting, with the language of Shakespeare, the pluck of Winston Churchill, and the charm of Margot Ledbetter? To discuss the meaning and relevance of Englishness, I'm joined by Damian Thompson, who was born in the Garden of England known as Kent, and Jenny McCartney, an observer of English life from Northern Ireland. Jenny, if I can start with you, in your opinion, what defines Englishness?
Well, I think the lines between Englishness and Britishness are still blurred because England was so long the dominant element in the Union. But I've made a little list with apologies for what I've left out of some things that strike me as English.
Okay.
A tea, irony, understatement, tolerance, restraint, class consciousness, pantomimes, pageantry, and an unparalleled range of potato crisps. And those are all things to be proud of, I think. Some of them were missing in Northern Ireland as I was growing up. But when I did come over here for the first time, I was surprised by how interested English people were in class. And I was rather pleased to be given a free pass out of that. I
mean, right. So you didn't belong in the class system because you were from outside of England?
I didn't. And that was quite a relief and nobody expected me to. Maybe I was just so obviously non-new that nobody bothered to categorise me. But I felt that the Celts en masse were exempt from the class system, and that was quite nice.
And so to what extent is Englishness then really defined by class? Because quite often when I think of Englishness, I do think of very middle class things. I mean, Damien, would you agree with that?
Yeah, English nationalism has a rather confected feel to it because until now, Britishness has effectively stood proxy, if you like, for English nationalism. But if you look at our attempts to be nationalistic, they're either slightly offensive or they're rather ridiculous. We famously don't have a national costume, but we're often defined by faintly embarrassing things. And when we do try and celebrate ourselves as English people, it has a sort of faint whiff of an office party. I mean, we're defined by things like saying sorry when people bump into us. And if you look at the so-called jingoism of the last night of the proms, actually it's embarrassing. But my point is that we didn't need to project an English national identity because, in fact, English culture, specifically upper middle class English culture, was the defining culture of the Union, not just of England.
Right. I mean, there are more, even more embarrassing things than that. I mean, there's the horror that is Morris dancing. There's people abroad wearing socks and sandals. There's the strange desire of all Englishmen in hot weather to take off their tops, even when the rest of us really don't want to see what's underneath. And then there's that extreme manners thing, which, I mean, I've always regarded myself as English to the point of disability. I mean, English to the point of not actually being able to communicate anything or articulate myself. Is that all that sort of madness? Is that what you think Englishness is?
I don't actually, and I think you're both being very English by being embarrassed about it, but I also think that that is changing. I think that cultural revivals are always driven by elites. I mean, the Irish revival in the early 20th century was driven by a fairly small elite of people like Yeats and Lady Gregory who wanted to redefine what Ireland meant, and they probed around in the past and came up with songs and all sorts of poetry. And I think a similar thing is happening now in England in that people are often no longer embarrassed about being English. And, you know, you're talking about Morris dancing. And I think there's a whole folk movement, especially among people younger than we are, who aren't ashamed of it. They're interested in craft. They're interested in locally sourced food. They're interested in folk music. And, you know, in Hoxton, men are sporting Edwardian beards. And this stuff has actually become frighteningly fashionable.
Right.
And an elite,
right.
In a way, a kind of social elite, is beginning to drive an English revival.
It is
not,
being
not in a
by
bad
elite.
Way.
Good God, Damien. The thought that the Hoxton hipsters in their moustaches and beards are some sort of social elite really
it
terrifies me.
It might upset
me.
You, Damien,
well,
but
I'll tell you
I think
what
it's
I think,
true.
I'll tell you what I think is happening. It's not so much that there's a revival of nationalism, but I think there's a real growth in English resentment towards other parts of the Union, especially Scotland. Scotland now has its own parliament. It has considerable powers, and for the first time, we're beginning to get really sick, I think, of Scottish chippiness, if I can be so rude, because
that is
it
very
was
rude,
understandable
yes.
when Scotland didn't have the degree of independent representation that it does now. But now that it's got a parliament, the continued resentment of many Scots towards England, I think, is causing a feeling of resentment. I'm sure if there was an opinion poll, in fact, I think there have been opinion polls, showing that if the vote for Scottish independence was up to England, Scotland would be independent tomorrow.
But is it resentment or is it jealousy? Is it not so much resentment of what you call chippiness, so much as it's jealousy that the Scottish are obviously going through a very exciting revival in their cultural identity, and it's and yet we just have the Hoxton beards and tea and manners to fall back on. They actually, you know, they're really finding a concrete identity for the first time that we don't
have. I don't think it's jealousy. I think, and again, you can't say this without being rude.
Well, you can't.
I can't say it without being rude. I've got the same, yes, same problem as you, perhaps because we were born in the same hospital.
We were born in exactly the same hospital. Not at the same time, many years apart.
I don't know, put it this way. Given that my boss is Scottish, I should be really, really careful. But sometimes when I go to Scotland, it feels more foreign than America. And I wonder if something to do with that is the fact that America's heritage is more English than it is British.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. If Damien went to Northern Ireland, would he feel very out of place there? Is there anything about Northern Irish culture which is somewhat English?
Well, I think it's different in that part of the reason I'm not a fan of nationalism generally is I grew up sandwiched between the Republican paramilitaries and the Loyalist paramilitaries, who both had very fervent forms of nationalism which were pretty toxic. One of the things I like about Britain, as opposed to every place kind of shouting about its individual identity, is that there is a more sort of varied and interesting notion of what a nation is. So I think Damien would find it different, but some of the things that I like about England are what makes it different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been to Ulster and I do indeed find it different. There's this faint sense, you see, the Orangemen with the Union flags and their bowler hats, and it's meant to be a demonstration of Britishness. But again, actually, to me, it feels as foreign as Irish republicanism.
Well, I think what happens there is their identity feels threatened, therefore they shout about it, which is, in a sense,
exactly.
What you're talking about with England's reaction
and I think
to a feeling
fact
about
the fact
Scotland.
That, I think the fact that England has not been invaded, but has rather invaded other countries, has a tremendous amount to do with the slightly reticent, taken-for-granted
right.
nature of our nationalism, if you can even call it that.
Although we fought that long war with Germany, we're not supposed to mention anymore, that did kind of define what we were, you know, the Mrs. Miniver, the Winston Churchill, the pluck element of the Blitz. I mean, there was a very English sense of identity.
And as I say, it was a very English sense of identity rather than a British sense of identity. And that's not fair, I have to say. Of course, people from other parts of the Union and other parts of the British Empire made enormous and sometimes disproportionate sacrifices.
Well, of course, Belfast was very heavily bombed.
Absolutely.
In the
I wonder sometimes if there isn't an element of guilt in our reluctance to celebrate English nationalism, but I think increasingly less so.
But I think there's all sorts of room for pride in Englishness. I mean, it has so much. I'm speaking about that separately from nationalism. Somewhere along the line, English people weren't allowed to feel romantic about England anymore. And I think it started after the First World War. You know, before that, you had Rupert Brooke and If There's Some Corner of a Foreign Field, It Is Forever England. And then it moved on to Wilfred Owen and The Great Shock. And the great lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, and the attitude towards patriotism and mm-hmm. nationalism changed. And then later on, writers like Kingsley Amis in Lucky Jim, the funniest, most mockable thing was his Professor Welsh, who wanted everyone to get together and sing madrigals, which is where, you know, the laughter at Morris dancing and so on
comes in. But I think the change happens in the 1950s with people like Kingsley Amis. I don't think it happens immediately after the First World War, partly because it was more fondly remembered in the 20s and 30s than it is today, but also because you have Stanley Baldwin, you have the Little England syndrome, and importantly, you still have an empire. And I think one of the reasons why we're uncomfortable about being English today is because we've lost the big thing that defined us for so many years, which was that very casual sense that we ran two-fifths of the world, and that's what made us great, and that's gone.
And I think it's also important to note that we have been taught to feel embarrassed about our colonial heritage. I mean, so many history lessons throughout Britain, but especially, I think, in English schools, focus very much on the patronising and oppressive aspects of the British Empire, as opposed to its achievements, and therefore you drink in a sense of national reticence bordering on shame.
Well, and
with your mother's milk.
Right.
Guilt tripping is part of the
English. The English know a lot about shame, and you know we're permanently ashamed of ourselves. You know, I just look in the mirror in the morning and I'm guilt ridden. So I think that guilt and shame about empire is probably justified. But one thing I wanted to close on, Jenny, you come from a society where nationalism is bifurcated by religion.
Hmm.
You know, what I imagine that what it means to be a Catholic Ulster person or a Protestant Ulster person is two very different things. And I wondered, because Damien and I are both Catholics, if it is possible to be a patriotic Catholic Englishman. Does our Catholicism not make us basically un-English?
I don't think that it does now, I think, because the great arguments about religion within English society are probably done with. I don't know whether you would agree.
And also, I think there have been generation after generation of very patriotic Catholics who, if anything, rather overcompensated. Because the same might be true of Jewish people in this country who made a disproportionate contribution to the nation's history precisely because they knew that their loyalty was being unfairly questioned.
Yeah, I'm still a little uncomfortable, though, whenever I see Catholic services ending with God Save the Queen or something.
I love it.
Really? Really?
Absolutely love it.
Yeah. I hate it because I think religion is to do with something beyond national identity, and I feel it's about trying to fit in, whereas for me what should be great about...
I think to pray for the Queen is a wonderful thing to do.
It's always a good thing
to do. It. And I still remember from my childhood a wonderful Irish priest who made us sing on the occasion of the Queen's Silver Jubilee, made us sing God Save the Queen. Didn't go down very well with the Irish congregation, but he insisted.
Well, may God save the Queen, because I suspect he won't save the English. Thank you very much, Jenny McCartney and Damien Thompson. For more opinion and commentary, you can find us all on telegraph.co.uk.